Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, traffic is bad in Massachusetts. Is it time to think about raising taxes to fix it?
Look, you know, we've done some things by this Band-Aid approach for decades. Let's take a big step back and take a dose of reality.
Also, UMass Boston students on the 2020 election and President Trump.
There is a lot of misinformation about who he is and what he does. It bothers me because, I mean, he's not able to deliver on some of the promises that he made to the American people.
Also today, checking in on sports, including reports that this could be Tom Brady's last year with the Patriots.
I don't know why all this is coming up. I have no idea. This is not being brought on by me.
Then, on this Halloween, we take a deep dive into Boston's thriving drag scene.
Well, there's drag every single night in this city.
Literally every night, you can go see a drag show somewhere within a couple miles of you.
Yeah.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. If you drive or take public transportation in and out of Boston, you know it is hard to get around. Today, the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce says it's time to take action, including new taxes. Jim Rooney is president and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. He's also a former interim general manager of the MBTA. He joined us in Studio 3 to talk about what the chamber thinks needs to be done.
We've called for short-term revenues in the form of some level of gas tax, and we've also expressed support for fees on so-called TNC vehicles, Uber and Lyft. So that's short-term, and then longer-term, we've suggested that the legislature create a 21st century roadway pricing task force, basically get some bright minds from across Massachusetts, academic institutions, financial people in the room to create applications of technology, be it tolls, congestion pricing, managed lanes.
So really a gas tax in the short term,
yes.
And then roadway tolls, congestion pricing, maybe toll lanes or increased toll booths on various roads, et cetera, as part of a larger, longer-term revenue strategy.
Well, we need to understand how are we going to pay for our consumption of mobility, regardless of whether it's public transportation or roadways going forward. I think most people understand that someday our vehicles are not going to be powered by gasoline, electric, or battery, or something else. But we're going to need money to maintain roads and bridges. We're going to need money to upgrade transportation systems and operate them. So where is that going to come from, and how are we going to raise that revenue? Most people believe that that's through some applications of technology, either through those large gantries that you see out on the turnpike that you can put in place quite easily now, that would apply a toll, that you might dial up for congestion purposes so that if you choose to drive by yourself at a busy period of the day, you might pay a little bit more. The governor's proposed managed lanes that would charge a premium to drive in something called an express lane. So there's a lot of ways to use the technology. So my suggestion would be that people think about applications of technology to incentivize behavior and to raise revenue at the same time.
So, Jim, in all those cases, somebody pays more. And one of the things that is striking is that, you know, an increase in the gas tax is a tax. That may be a tough sell to this governor. Did you talk with the governor's office about this report, and what kind of reaction have you been getting there?
Well, the governor's position and that of Secretary Pollock has been quite clear that they do not favor a gas tax, so we understand that. But we've done a lot of work and research on this, and as we look at the way that we've chosen to price transportation really since the early 90s, what's happened is the cost of riding public transportation has gone up over 250%. Since 1991, the gas tax has gone up once, 3 cents in 2013. So consciously or unconsciously, we've made a decision that we're willing to increase the fee or the cost of consuming mobility on public transportation by 250%, while at the same time, just 3 cents over almost 30 years on driving. Inflation alone, if we wanted to just say, okay, what if we gave the gas tax the same buying power it had in 1991, the gas tax would be 16 cents higher.
Now, you're also pushing for increased T ridership, more people in collective or public transportation. How does that get done?
Well, there's two ways. I mean, one is through investments in making it more reliable and dependable. I think people are making non-economic decisions today because they have to get to work, to the meeting, and they're making the decision, can I depend on my commuter rail or my red line
ride? And they're saying they can't.
They're saying they can't in many circumstances. So they're shifting to an Uber or a Lyft or driving themselves and making a non-economic decision because generally that costs more.
How do you get at that? How do you make the team more reliable? That seems to be a real boogeyman for us. No, Halloween pun intended.
That's our point, is that the administration has a good plan of investment, and they've actually done some things this year that they haven't done in a long time, which is these shutdowns on weekends, these diversions on the Orange Line that we're experiencing now. To try to accelerate the pace of improvement, they have to do more of that. And one of the points that we make is that we feel empowered to make these recommendations because MassDOT and the MBTA are better managed today than they were 5 years ago. The group that's in charge now has shown that they can do the job. So now we've got to give them the resources.
So there's been a lot of public conversation about big, bold solutions to the transportation challenges of our complicated and growing economy, our growing sprawl across greater Boston and Massachusetts. Does this do enough? The things in your report, are they the big, bold vision that gets us to a better equilibrium?
We hope so. And that's this concept of future ready that we talk about. We need to sit back and take a comprehensive look about being ready for population growth, continued economic development, climate change, try to deal with issues like our housing crisis.
And what if we don't? What if we don't take the recommendations in this report?
Well, if we don't, we're going to have the same frustrations we have taking public transportation and congestion. Our highway and roadway and bridge conditions are going to continue to deteriorate. We won't be ready for the climate changes that are taking place. We need to reduce emissions. We won't be ready for that. And our ability to sustain both our population and our economic growth will be put in a detrimental position. MassBio did a very well done recent study that said that 60% of the people in the biotech industry, one of the key industries of Massachusetts, says that if this doesn't get better, we would consider leaving. That should be a warning sign.
That's Jim Rooney, president and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. He led the study released today. He's also a former interim general manager of the MBTA. Jim, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
So much going on in the world of sports this week. So let's take some time now to check the score with Chris Siderick. Chris!
Hey, Tiziana.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Okay, there is a lot of stuff going on right here in Boston, but I actually think we have to start with a wild World Series Game 6 last night in Houston. For folks who missed it, can you give us the recap?
Yeah, it was a crazy game, and this World Series needed it because it has been pretty much a snooze fest since Game 1. This was actually last night the first lead change in this entire series since Game 1. Pretty unreal. But anyway, the Houston Astros are up 2-1. The Nationals come back to tie it up in the fifth. They go up 1 run, 3-2. A 1-run lead in baseball is never safe. One pitch, one swing of the bat can wipe that off the board, obviously. So getting a couple more runs is a big deal in that scenario. Nationals leadoff hitter Trey Turner finds himself hitting a slow grounder down the third base line. He is safe at first, but the umps actually call him out for runner interference. Let's take a listen to what that sounded like on the broadcast last night.
Let's take another look. You can run in this spot. You have to veer back towards the bag, and that is a tough call. He was inside the bag all the way to the end.
But, I mean, he's right on it.
So this is a tough situation because he
I'd
runs.
Crack it up. They're showing so much restraint, but in the moment.
You can feel it in their voice, right?
Yeah.
That this was a really controversial call. And Joe Buck even said this could be a series-changing call. Turner runs right up the baseline. He's technically in fair territory, so technically this is the right call. But ultimately, first base is in fair territory, so the runner kind of has to be in fair territory, especially at the end of the line there. So anyway, it looked like that could end up actually tainting the whole series, could end up ending it. If Houston won last night, that ends the series. They're the champs. But fortunately for the Nationals, Adam Eaton pops out, and then the next hitter, Anthony Rendon, steps to the plate and did this.
Now there with two out, and Rendon shoots one into left. Back at the wall, it is gone! Anthony Rendon! And the lead is three here in the seventh inning for the Nationals. It's 5-2 as Rendon may have just rescued this inning for Washington.
Huge, huge moment in terms of momentum. The Nationals go on to win, send it to Game 7. As they say, ball don't lie.
Wait, what?
Ball don't lie. It's kind of this, I love this concept. It's sports karma, basically. They were robbed by the umpires, and so ultimately the ball delivers true justice.
Yeah, you know balls can't do that, right?
I'm telling you, this is a thing. Trust me.
All right, listen, I just got to ask. This was, again, in Houston. Has anyone won a home game yet?
Not in this series, which is the first time that's ever happened.
It's kind of freaky.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I heard the Nationals pitcher, Steven Strasburg, was actually, it's like poker. He had a tell. He was tipping his pitches.
Yeah. This is actually a really interesting story. There's a great Sports Illustrated article that folks should check out. They give you kind of the inside play-by-play of what happened. A Nationals scouting coordinator noticed that he's doing it. This has been an ongoing thing for Strasburg throughout his career. He kind of shows the grip that he's putting on the ball, and batters can tell what pitch he's going to throw based on how he grabs the ball. And so the scouting coordinator says to the pitching coach, he's doing it again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pitching coach is in this weird spot where he has to decide. Strasburg is one of those kind of those enigmas athletes. Don't talk to me,
yes.
Basically, while I'm pitching. Don't talk to me.
A little bit of a touchy guy.
But ultimately, you're tipping your pitches. You kind of have to let your pitcher know that. So the pitching coach speaks to Strasburg. Strasburg fixes what he's doing and ends up going into the ninth inning and pitching incredibly well. He was asked on the field afterwards whether or not he realized he was tipping his pitches at the time.
I definitely didn't because, you know, it's something that, you know, has burned me in the past, and they burned me there in the first. But, you know, it's just a part of the game. And, you know, you got to do your best to, you know, stay consistent in your delivery on each pitch.
Once again, with the understatement.
Yeah, exactly right. That's a big part of baseball is trying to figure out what's coming next. Clearly, changing his delivery made the difference. He gave up those two runs in the first pitch into the ninth inning without giving up another run.
So that really could have been the thing.
Yeah, it seems like it was.
All right, so tonight is Game 7. All bets are off in the Game 7 of a World Series. So what are you watching for?
Ultimately, first of all, there's nothing better than a Game 7, right? Because literally anything can happen. Anyone on the bench could end up in the game in any situation. Any pitcher in the bullpen could end up in the game.
Everything's on the line. End up in the game.
You never know, right? But ultimately, this one is about the pitching matchup, actually. You've got Max Scherzer is going to be starting for the Nationals. That's a big deal. He was actually scratched from his start over the weekend with neck spasms. He was in a neck brace this weekend, could not turn his head at all. He was warming up last night in the bullpen. He will be starting tonight.
I'm actually kind of worried about him.
I mean, it's one of those things. It's what athletes do. They're paid the big bucks to perform in the big moments, and Game 7 World Series is about as big as it gets. He's going up against Zach Greinke for the Astros. It's the first time ever, actually, that two former Cy Young winners are starting Game 7 of a World Series. So tonight's all about the pitching matchup.
Yeah. And your prediction?
I mean, the Astros have been the heavy favorite all along.
Go
Nats!
I got
to pick the Nationals. Everybody loves the underdog, right?
That's right. So, yeah. Well, they do Baby Shark, so I want to go.
All right. Don't get me started.
Let's shift gears. We'll go to the Pats because we've been talking about them off and on for these first 8 weeks. And I have said to you, let's say that I have expressed some concern about the entertainment value of the games.
They're boring. Their games have been boring. You've said that. And I told you, you're not wrong. They have been boring.
Will the next one be boring?
Hopefully not. This is the best game they've had so far this year. They're going up against Baltimore. Baltimore looks like one of the strongest teams in the AFC. So it should be a good matchup. Baltimore also has a pretty long history with New England. They're one of those franchises that's not afraid to play the Patriots. A lot of teams seem intimidated just coming into Foxborough. This game's in Baltimore. But it'll be interesting to see how they match up. Baltimore has a very mobile quarterback. He runs a lot. Pat's defense obviously has looked phenomenal this year. So it should be a good matchup.
Okay, but the Pats are 8-0. Baltimore may be tough, but so far we don't have any reason to believe the Pats will lose. Are we looking at an undefeated season?
So this is starting to be talked about in Boston sports media.
They were talking about it in August.
It's on the table. These guys have maybe the best defense this team has ever seen. One of the best the NFL has ever seen, I think. They are playing at a phenomenal clip right now. the phrase 19-0 gives me triggers a little bit because of 2007. That is still one of the five worst days of my life. I will never forget that. So there's the added pressure of trying to finish the 19-0. But you think of all the things that this team has accomplished. This is the kind of that one thing they haven't accomplished. So I wouldn't be surprised if deep down Belichick and Brady want that.
All right. And very quickly, you've mentioned D a couple of times. That is kind of the definitive characteristic of this year's team. And it's a little weird.
It's a little weird for folks because it's been a while since we've seen it. But for me, I love it. This harkens back to those 2003, 2004 teams where the defense was the driving force. And the offense is just there to kind of manage the game and to protect the ball. You got to love, these guys have given themselves a nickname, the Boogeymen, which just takes me right back to the 70s and 80s with the Steel Curtain and the Purple People Eaters. And I love a good nickname. So you got to root for these guys.
All right. Now, shifting gears, you shocked me a couple of months ago with the possibility Tom Brady might play somewhere else. But it's kind of sounding like people are talking about that.
Yeah, I think Adam Schefter from ESPN really kind of sparked that about a week ago. He's pretty plugged into the NFL scene. He has a lot of inside sources. And he said, basically, look, there are three scenarios. Brady comes back to the Pats, Brady retires, or Brady goes somewhere else. He said he thinks coming back to the Pats would be the least likely scenario. So that caught a lot of people's ears. He's walked it back a little bit since then. But Brady's been a little bit on the fence about this issue. Here he is talking with Jim Gray in his weekly interview on Westwood One this Monday.
Someone told me the past and future are in the mind. I'm in the now. And I think that's a great way to live life. So I'm not thinking about many things beyond this week.
And I just want to play one other cut from him. This is from back in August, right after he signed his most recent contract. Just take a listen to how he words his response when he was asked if he was happy with his contract.
It is what it is. That's a good line. So whoever said it, it's very pertinent. So like I said, there's a lot of guys who have, you know, 1 year left on their contract. So the situation, I got 1 year to go, and we'll see what happens.
As they would say in politics, he's running.
Yeah, cryptic, right? So, look, he sold his house. He changed the wording in his contract. So, basically, the contract expires at the end of the year. The team can't franchise tag him, which means they can't bring him back at the going market rate for a one-year period. Who knows? It's undecided. I don't know if he knows what he's doing yet, but it's definitely on the table that he could be wearing a different uniform.
Okay, there's the Halloween scare for the Patriots.
I'm not rooting
fans.
For that. I am not rooting for that. It could happen.
That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, stay with us. Coming up, we will talk to college students about how they're looking at 2020. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. The proportion of young adults who voted in last year's midterm election was the highest in a century. And analysts are expecting an even higher turnout from young voters in 2020. So to get a sense of what young voters are thinking about politics, we invited three of them into our studio. All are students at UMass Boston. Monica Reyna Gonzalez is a junior, and Opal Polynice and Fareen Khan are both sophomores. And they began by telling us the key issues on their minds. Here's Monica.
The most important political issue for me right now is equity. I feel that this administration, it has highlighted all the inequalities, all the gaps, and all the broken systems that have made our society as unequal and as difficult to navigate as it is right now.
So in your mind, mm-hmm. when you say equity, what does that mean?
For me, it doesn't mean giving everybody the same thing. It means giving people what they need to achieve the same opportunities.
Okay, Fareen, how about you? What's the most important issue for you right now?
I think reproductive rights. I think there's an inherent misunderstanding in the American public what the pro-choice movement stands for.
Opal, how about you? What's the most important issue for you?
Well, I'm pretty pro-life, and so the most important issue for me is defending life. And I think there's a lot of misconception about what life is and what that means to be pro-life. And so that's a hot-button issue for me.
So I want to emphasize the women for a minute, because we have three young women on this panel. So what I'd like to do for the next couple of policy questions, I want to take specifically a woman's lens on the policy issues. And let's begin, although it is sensitive, with healthcare and specifically women's reproductive health. Fareen, you touched on the fact that your number one issue was women's reproductive health. So be more specific there. What inside of that concept for you as a young woman in America is important to you?
So I do believe that abortion is a human right. We will never tell a woman that they should get an abortion, but we will say that it's wrong for you to tell another woman that she cannot get an abortion because of your religion. And I think religion should stay out of politics, because religious freedom does not say, oh, you can't do this because my religion says it's wrong. Religious freedom says, this is my experience, this is my personal experience, and I'm not going to do this because my religion feels it's wrong.
Okay, let me turn to Opal now, because Opal, you then said is one of your key issues that you were pro-life, and that was a fundamental issue in this election for
right.
you. So especially in response to what you've heard from Farin as another young woman in America, why is that important to you, and what does that mean today and in the 2020 election?
I do believe that you don't have the right to take somebody else's life. They call it my right, it's my choice, but that's another life inside of you. I don't see how you have the right to impede on that life, because I don't see the difference between it being a life in your stomach and it being a life outside of the stomach. Like, either way, that's still a human being.
So many women who have struggled with the tension between the law giving woman autonomy to make healthcare decisions about her own body and the concept that a baby in utero is a separate life see some tension between the claims that baby has and the claims a woman has to her own body in making her own healthcare decisions.
Okay.
As a young woman, how do you think about that tension?
I don't see autonomy including you having the right to decide whether a child lives or not. And I kind of want to address how you addressed religion. I don't think we should live in a church state, but I mean, religion has always informed political thought. I don't think it should be a federal mandate that we should provide for reproductive health, because, you know, if it goes against my religion.
If I can just interject here, I have respect for life in the womb, but if I'm ever in that position and I have to go to a doctor's office, I don't want anyone else making that choice for me. If I have to terminate a pregnancy, that is between me, my God, and my doctor.
Let's move now to the question of immigration. The three of you each have very different lived experiences when it comes to that set of policy issues. Let me just begin by saying, do each of you agree that our current immigration system is broken? I'll start with you, Farin.
I would say that there's like an inherent, I feel like, racism almost. Broken isn't the term I would use. It gets tossed around a lot. I would say it's more disorganized.
Why do you object to the concept of broken? Because it is a term that gets used a lot. And one might say, well, if it's inherently racist, how is that not broken?
I think you can fix the immigration system. So that's why I would say it's more disorganized than broken.
And do you have in mind one particular fix that you think is essential or would be most helpful?
I'd start by not banning an entire religion, like the Muslim ban that Trump tried to enact. Like, that's a very disorganized policy, and it's inherently discriminatory.
So, Monica, what's your feeling on sort of the health of our current immigration system?
Well, I've had the immense privilege of working in a congressional office as a casework fellow, and a lot of that was doing immigration work, which is write to our agencies and ask for updates or for help navigating the system. I wouldn't say it's broken. It does not work. There are so many channels that don't communicate with each other. There are so many systems and forms that people need to repeatedly fill out. And it's just a system that isn't communicating with itself. So you can be dealing with ICE or you can be dealing with the visa center. But they're not talking to each other. So your visa can be in the mail on its way to your house, but you can be in a detention center and willingly choose to deport yourself or look at 3 weeks in that center while your parents get your visa to the judge who adjudicates that it is valid. So I'm not getting this information from CNN or the New York Times. I'm getting it from a really personal experience of having to sit down with a lot of people in my communities and in immigrant communities and have to talk them through why they have to fill out 10 different forms from 3 different agencies. I think that if we sit them all together and get them to create channels that talk to each other, processes that are much more simple to navigate, then I think we can fix a really big problem.
Opal, do you think that young people of your generation have a different experience with or understanding of or critique about the way the United States handles immigration?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of it is exacerbated by social media. You know, we watch these now this 1 minute clips on Twitter and we don't really take the time to inform ourselves just how complicated this system is, especially there are a lot of crises going on in other countries now. And so there's a influx of immigrants coming from everywhere. And it's really hard to process this because you really do have to make sure that you're admitting people who are safe to come into the country, because you have a country to protect, right? I'm not anti-immigrant. My parents are immigrants, but I think they're underestimating, you know, how difficult it is to ensure the safety of a country, if that makes sense.
And so you do see questions of border security and national security as tied up in immigration policy?
Absolutely. I think, okay, so I know I'm going to probably receive a lot of flack for this, but I think, for example, the border wall ties into that a lot, and I am actually for the wall.
Either of you opposed to the wall?
Yes.
Yes. I think the wall is, I honestly believe it would be a waste of money. They don't seem to understand that people will always find a way around whatever you have.
So you just don't think it would work?
I don't think they would work, and I don't think it's necessary. I think it's a waste of money.
How about you, Monica?
I agree with Farine. I first want to go back to something that you said, Opal, that I agree with you. I think that a lot of us are being informed by one-minute videos, clickbaits, and hashtags. I think that it takes a lot of self-discipline to take a step away from that and take everything into consideration holistically. But the wall doesn't work. The three of us, our heritage is not from the United States. Our parents or we came from different places, and it wasn't that border that we crossed. So pinpointing the Mexican border as the point of problem is unrealistic, and a concrete structure is also not the most feasible way to secure that border.
So here's what I think I'm hearing from the three of you, that where the common ground is that A, a system that allows for immigration is actually important, and B, that there is some relationship between border security, national security, and immigration. But C, you're not only concerned about equity, but also about efficacy and spending money in the ways that you think will most work across that set of interests. Does that seem fair?
Yeah.
Let's talk about President Trump. Most of the conversation about primary season in primary 2020 is about the Democratic primary, where there's been a very wide field. But the Republican incumbent, Donald Trump, is also running for re-election as president of the United States. Are any of the three of you interested in supporting President Trump in the 2020 election?
I am, actually.
So yeah. Talk some more about that, Opal.
Yeah. I can feel the death stares. It's okay.
No. It's not you, it's him.
Oh, well, I mean, I think, again, there is a lot of misinformation about who he is and what he does. For example, if you look at the Mueller report, right, and the FBI spent, what, $35 million in 2 years trying to find collusion with Russia, and there wasn't any, you know what I'm saying? And he's still just getting hounded and hounded. Like, I mean, I think it is appropriate for him to say it is a witch hunt at this point. I think there are people in certain positions who actively work against him. It bothers me because, I mean, he's not able to deliver on some of the promises that, you know, he made to the American people when he was running in the 2016 election. It bothers me because, you know, when certain people in positions of power did the same thing to Obama, you know what I'm saying? It was called unfair, unjust, and, you know, so why is it any different with him?
So let me ask you one other question. Are you voting for President Trump because it's President Trump? Are you first and foremost voting for President Trump because you're a Republican? Or is there no distinction between those two things?
I think there is a distinction. I think a lot of the Democratic candidates are focused on very, like, policies that are socialistic in nature. I would never vote for somebody who would implement socialist policies because they don't help generate wealth. Only capitalism can do that.
So the three of you are such strong women with such clear ideas and understanding in your own minds of how you want women to be able to navigate the world around them. We are in such an interesting moment for women right now. We're 2 years out of the hashtag MeToo movement launching. Here's what I'm curious about. Do you feel that the emergence of movements like hashtag MeToo have affected the way you can navigate school, work, life, dating, etc.? And do you have any thoughts about or concerns of backlash?
This is Farine. The MeToo movement was to, like, shine a light on sexual assault and how that needs to be addressed. It's not there for men to become resentful of women because suddenly they're unsure of what to say. I really think men don't understand that, like, they can't just ask women. And this doesn't go for just men. This goes for women, too, because the Me Too movement isn't just about women who are victims. Men are victims as well.
Now, Opal, you were specifically nodding at something that Fareen said.
I think this might be the one area where we somewhat agree. No, because I mean, it's not fair for people to use the position of power that they're in to manipulate or subject them to inappropriate, you know, forms of intimacy, contact or anything like that. And so I think that was a very important step for women and people in general, because, I mean, even if you take sexual harassment out of the picture, how are other power plays being made to mm-hmm. make people do what you want them to do?
Yeah, it's not just women who are the victims.
Monica.
I tried to think back before Me Too, like, how did we have conversations about the boss who harassed me? Did we? If we had a creepy professor, how would we talk about it before Me Too? I also think that men being uncomfortable with Me Too is a little frustrating. It's just a matter of conversation. We're not attacking anyone, and we're calling out who needs to be called out.
Monica Reyna Gonzalez, Fareen Khan, and Opal Polonese, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you for having us.
Stay with us. Coming up, why Halloween is an important time in the drag community. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
I am being haunted. Haunted.
Halloween. It's a time for trick-or-treating, scary movies, pumpkin brews, and drag. You may not know it, but October is the busiest month of the year for drag queens and kings. And I am joined in studio by three radiant local drag performers, Kirby Fully Loaded, Severity Stone, and Binks. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Kirby, Severity, Binks, later we will have video and pictures on our website. But for now, because this is radio, can you describe your look? Kirby, let's have you go first.
Today I am wearing a handmade jack-o'-lantern inspired all orange and black look with really big shoes.
With really big shoes. I can't see your shoes. They're under the table. But and your makeup? Anything you want to say about your makeup?
Oh, sure. It's like candy corn colors with a little bit of spooky black elements.
Excellent.
Tie it all together.
There you go. Binks, how about you?
I'm the Wicked Witch of the West before the house fell on top of her. So just a black gown. And I kind of like Morticia, maybe.
Yeah, a little bit of Morticia.
I like a V-bang.
You got a bit of a Maleficent thing going, too, without the horns.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Severity, how about you?
I just look like a regular nice woman. Just no. Kidding, I don't. I couldn't decide whether to be a goblin, a skeleton, Frankenstein, or a zombie, or a witch, so I did all three. And I'm green.
So, any... True. Very green, as a matter of fact. Any inspirations beyond the characters that you just... Like Candy Corn, Wicked Witch of the West, 17 different things for you, Severity. Any other inspirations behind your looks today or how you're thinking about dressing for Halloween?
I mean, I have a big, like, exciting Halloween look that I've been working on for, like, a month that's really inspired by Lucy Westerna from Bram Stoker's Dracula. Mm-hmm. I just think she's, like, the prettiest mm-hmm. vampire I've ever seen, so.
So you're going all in on that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's with, like, the big frilly mm-hmm. collar. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about Halloween, because a lot of our listeners may not know, Halloween is an important holiday in the drag world. Is that correct?
Oh, of course.
So, Binks, tell us about that.
I think like Halloween would probably be my favorite time of year in general, but like for drag queens, like in drag kings, I think that's like one of the times of year like we're most like paid and booked, and like we have the most gigs and are put on the biggest platform to show besides Pride in June. But I would say Halloween would be either the first or the second most popular time for us to show what we're doing.
So it's not only popular for you, but it's an income time for your
oh, yes.
performances as well. Is that right?
Definitely. I am paying my rent with this money.
All right. Severity, you were nodding. What would you add to that?
I agree. It is an important time for drag entertainers who wish to indulge in Halloween. I know a lot of people, when you dress up professionally pretty much all year, it can be kind of like exhausting to, you know, put in the extra work during Halloween. It's basically like working at Macy's during Christmas. You know, it's like doing drag during October. It's like, ugh, like it's kind of like... It's great. It's a lot of fun, but it's also like a lot of work, and it's like very taxing sometimes, you know, depending on what you do and how often you perform. But it's definitely a lot of fun, and it's definitely it me personally, it inspires me to like bring out that extra amount of energy or that extra effort into like creating a look that I probably normally wouldn't wear, you know, any other time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm always a little bit Halloween-y if anyone knows me, but you know, it's different, you know.
Kirby, was Halloween important to you growing up?
Oh, really important to me. I think it was like this time where I got to create with like important adults in my life that were like teaching me how to sew and put together costumes. And it was just really exciting. I remember spending like the entire month of September thinking about like what I would be that year. And I always coordinated with one of my best friends. So that was always like a super fun time. It's how I learned how to sew. And yeah, it was just like pure fun.
Binks, the craftsmanship that goes into the makeup and the costumes that the three of you wear, not just at Halloween. I've looked through sort of your Instagram history and some of your other costumes, if that's an appropriate word to use. These are extremely technical, complicated, high art costumes. How much time does it take you to create a complete look?
Depends how inspired I am. And sometimes I can make like an entire outfit in a couple days if I really sit down to do it. I like to kind of take my time sometimes. I would say like the most a week is like how long I would like to spend on an outfit making it. But it could be a day if I have, you know, enough ambition to do it, get it done that day. I did recently start making a lot of my own stuff, so it's really fun. But sometimes it can be really boring to sit with a sewing machine for hours.
Sewing can be quite boring.
Yes. Yeah.
Severity.
Yes.
Halloween is a time when people get to step outside of themselves. Everyone gets to. It's a time when you can assume a different identity, a different persona. My perception, as somebody who clearly is not someone who's got a lot of experience with drag, is that part of drag is pushing social boundaries. First, is that a reasonable or fair thing to say? And does Halloween actually, is it a time when you, as it, doing drag, push boundaries less or just more and in new ways? Do you understand what my question is?
I do. I feel like in general, again, you know, it's all suggestive. A lot of people do drag for a lot of different reasons. I think it's always in some way about pushing boundaries and challenging the ideas of like gender and like how we present ourselves and how we want the world to like see us, you know, whether it's a character or if it's like an extension of your own self. Halloween, I guess, again, depending on who you are, can bring that out more, you know, and more people who may otherwise not be as inspired to dress up or try something new or whatever, like would be more so inclined, you know, during this season.
Kirby, I want to ask you, Severity just brought up the concept of gender, and we've talked, as we were talking to you guys before this segment, about how drag is a way to be playful and experimental with gender. It's not just guys dress up as girls.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just gender binary play either. So I kind of want to ask you, you were raised as a woman. Your drag is feminine. How did you come to drag?
I came to drag through friends and community and obviously things like RuPaul's Drag Race and being exposed to, like, drag on bigger platforms. But drag includes all of the things I've always been really passionate about. I was a makeup artist before I was a drag artist, making costumes and performance. So it made sense to be a drag queen, but no one told me that I could be a drag queen because I was raised a woman, and I had never seen that before. And then in the age of Instagram and the internet, you get to see so many people that you wouldn't normally see and hear their voices. And I was lucky to experience all kinds of gendered people that sort of gave me permission to start. And then once I started, it was just kind of took off.
Binks, how did you come to drag?
Kind of the same I was always really, really into fashion and kind of to bring it back to what you said earlier about like wearing a costume. I never really consider what I wear to be a costume. Like everything I consider, like I'm very into fashion. So like if it wouldn't be on a runway, it wouldn't be on me. it's just a different way of dressing to me. And I was always, always, always into fashion, and men's fashion could only be pushed so far. It was like a whole world of just women's clothes that I was not able to really grasp. I could always see it in magazines and on runways, and I could never wear it. And then I kind of saw people doing drag, and I was like, oh, I could wear fashion too. That isn't, you know, just men's and really cool.
So you said once that your childhood inspiration, one of your childhood inspirations, was Cruella de Vil.
Oh, yes. And I love Cruella.
Yeah, so why?
I don't. She was just like the coolest female to me. I don't know why. She always was dressed like Glenn Close in like the live action one. It was just my favorite. Like, she had so many cool outfits. She didn't really care. She kind of just did whatever she wanted and looked really cool doing it. Like, I loved all of her outfits.
I want to stay on the fashion conversation for a minute. So earlier in my career, the first time I became the head of an organization, mm-hmm. I figured out very quickly that if I dressed very glamorously, mm-hmm. that was really a signal of my power, and it gave me command in a room that I couldn't have otherwise.
Oh, yeah, no one can ever tell me anything when I look like this, because you just look so amazing. There's nothing anyone can say to you.
It makes you feel powerful?
Yeah, walking down the street, no one can say anything because I look so much better than you. Like, not to be like cocky or anything, but
no,
like,
today you definitely
my
look
outfit
than
is
me.
Amazing, and people are in like jeans and t-shirts, so like you can't say anything to me.
So that makes me wonder, when you're not in drag,
yeah,
well, let me put it this way, when do you feel more you?
There's both times when like I can be, because I dress really nicely as a boy too sometimes. I can definitely be in sweatpants and like a t-shirt and just be like chilling, but like fashion to me is on both sides, so it just depends on my outfit is how real I feel, truly myself, depending on the outfit. But in drag more so, because I do push fashion more in drag.
Saviri, let's talk about Boston.
You don't want to talk fashion about fashion Boston. Anymore?
Well,
I was ready to talk.
Well, do. Jump in. If you got stuff to say on fashion, you should do so. Jump in.
Well, I just was kind of like agreeing with most of what Binks is saying, with like growing up, kind of looking up to like villains and heroines and like kind of these empowered like female figures, whether they were like fictional or not. And definitely this, the fashion, like supermodel aspect, you know, when I was a kid, I used to draw, you know, like comic book character, like super voluptuous, like women in these like crazy costumes and stuff. And that's kind of like what got me on the path of like getting and experimenting in drag and that whole thing. And it's like, I never was trying to like emulate a woman, but it's like Binks was saying, like having some, I think it was Wesley Snipes said in Tu Wong Fu, is like, oh, I'm just like, I'm paraphrasing, like being too fabulous for like one gender, like kind of thing. And
you're
like
too much fashion for one gender.
Yeah. Something. Yeah. Again, paraphrasing, but yeah, that's where kind of like it stemmed from. And I was always more interested in like feminine fashion, and
it's so much more fun.
Just so much more fun, and there's only so much, you know, you can do, you know.
Is men's fashion starting to catch up? Are we entering an age where there's more experimentation that a young person could do with men's fashion than they could even 5 years ago or 10 years ago? Or am I just...
I think it's more like those things are becoming more blurred. Like, there's more androgynous fashion options out there, I think, and more lines and designers who are thinking about making clothing less strictly gendered.
What do you say, what is your message, any of the three of you, to people who are profoundly uncomfortable with that idea, profoundly uncomfortable with the idea that we should blur the lines between fashion or gender identity or our more traditional understandings of men wear pants and women wear skirts? I mean, the whole Hillary Clinton in pants thing was just a couple years ago, but still a really big deal. Like, it was some big thing that she was wearing pants. So how do you address people who greet you with discomfort?
Don't wear what I'm wearing. Wear what you want to wear. I'll wear what I want to wear. And we'll stay away from each other. I don't know. To me, it's like, to judge somebody based on what they're wearing, like, you're not wearing it. You don't have to wear it. Don't look at it. You know, like, we're not forcing anybody else to dress like us. We're not forcing anybody else to wear makeup with us. If you don't want to look at us, don't look at us. Just walk away.
Just walk away.
Yeah. I mean, it's not your life. Yeah. There's no laws to say I can't dress like this.
And if you want to wear a Red Sox jersey, like, that's fine, you know.
I'm not going to judge you.
That's
I'm
going to
judge you, but I'll be nice about it.
Yeah, you know.
Is that because you don't like the fashion or you're not a Sox?
Both.
Go Red Sox.
Yay, we love the Red Sox.
All right. I do want to come back to Boston. So a few weeks ago was Boston Fashion Week. We had an interview here on Radio Boston where we talked about the aspirations from the founder of Boston Fashion Week that over time Boston might stop being sort of dissed for how poor fashion is in Boston. But my understanding that is that in the drag community, Boston is actually quite cutting edge and leading edge. Is that right? Is that an accurate perception?
Why'd you both look at me?
I think we're getting there. I'm actually doing a show next year. I am planning on working with a lot of people in Boston with who make and create their own stuff, and we're actually going to do a fashion show. I don't have a date for it yet, but I have talked to the venue, and they did say yes. But we're going to make a show based on people who make stuff, queer people who make their own things in Boston, like wigs, makeup, outfits, clothes, and put on a fashion show at some point next year. So there are people who do, it's not really thought of as Boston, but we do make some really cool clothes and fashion and looks.
And Kirby, how about the overall drag scene in Boston? How would you characterize it?
I love it so much. I have never been happier in my life than being engaged in this community. And I think something that we're doing really right is focusing on expanding diversity and just really thinking about including everybody and supporting all different kinds of art and just being really open to new people in our community, because the bigger it is, the better it is, in my opinion.
Severity, when you perform, would you refer to it as performance art? Do you think of yourself as a performance artist? And if not, how do you think about your work?
Absolutely. Well, I think everything that we do, if we're on stage performing, is performance art. I don't know how to answer that question.
Well, let me ask you a different one then. As you think about preparing for a performance,
okay,
what are all the pieces that go into that preparation for you?
It all depends. You know, sometimes it's music inspired. Like, I'll hear a song and be like, oh, this would be like a cool thing that I could do with this. Or I'll get like an image of like a look that I want to do. I think for me personally, a lot of my drag is like visual based. Like, I'm not like a dancer or like much of a comedian, but I like to put together, you know, the head to toe look and have it, you know, tell a story, whether it is, you know, something silly or something dramatic. I think that's kind of what it stems from, is like the visual art, because I've been a visual artist since I was a child.
What kind of art did you start with?
Everything. sculpting, painting, mixed media stuff. I went to art school, ceramics, different stuff, animation, lots and lots of drawing as a wee lad. Everything. You could ask my family, you know, growing up, if I could do anything with my hands. Like, I was always like creating stuff.
And Severity, how would you say that Boston's drag scene has evolved since you first started in it?
It's evolved tremendously. I've been involved in the scene for like about 8-ish years at this point, from when I first started. And it was not nearly as like diverse and interesting as it is now. It was kind of very, like we were saying at the beginning, like guys dressed up as ladies in sequin dresses, and that was just kind of like it. Or at least that was it, all that I saw. And that's all that I was like educated on in the beginning, you know, first coming out and stuff. I learn something new like every time I come out, and I meet like a new entertainer like every time I come out, and I think that's like incredible.
Binks, what do you think is the next stage of evolution for Boston's drag community? Where are we going?
I don't really know. I think we're going to, I hope we're going to places where we don't have to just perform at like 1 o'clock in the morning every night. I would like to see drag just in different places that you wouldn't expect it. Like in, brunches are becoming really popular. There's a lot of them popping up. But like, even like places where we don't have to perform would be like really cool. It's like a place I would like to see drag, like in magazines. Like in New York City, it's like not impossible to get inside a magazine being a drag queen doing fashion. In Boston, that's like unheard of. I don't know where I would ever find that. So I think that would be really cool to see, like, in Boston, drag queens doing something else besides performing at nightclubs and bars.
And maybe part of Boston Fashion Week.
Yes, maybe.
Boston Fashion Week, if you're listening.
Maybe if my show's good next year, we'll get there.
Kirby, sort of in last words, what does the drag community mean to you as a performer and a person?
Ooh, that's a good one. It's definitely, like, family in a lot of ways, and it's a space where I definitely have felt really safe to express myself however that may look, without being worried about being questioned or and just feeling overwhelming support for the most part. Yeah, and it's a place where you can witness people like really being vulnerable and intimate and expressing their creativity. And I think that's a beautiful thing. We don't get that everywhere in this world. So
that is Kirby Fully Loaded. And you can find Kirby and Binks tomorrow night performing at the Shore Leave Tiki Bar in the South End. And you can find Severity Stone performing at the Halloween Night Spooktacular at the Royale. There will be more information, photos, and video on our website, radioboston.org. Thanks to all three of you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.